And our text today is Leviticus chapters 17 and 18. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons and to all the people of Israel, and say to them, 'This is the thing that the Lord has commanded. If anyone of the house of Israel kills an ox or lamb or a goat in the camp, or kills it outside the camp, and does not bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting to offer it as a gift to the Lord in front of the tabernacle of the Lord, blood guilt shall be imputed to that man. He has shed blood, and that man shall be cut off from among his people. This is to the end that the people of Israel may bring their sacrifices that they sacrifice in the open field, that they may bring them to the Lord, to the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and sacrifice them as sacrifices of peace offerings to the Lord. And the priest shall throw the blood on the altar of the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and burn the fat for a pleasing aroma to the Lord. So they shall no more sacrifice their sacrifices to goat demons, after whom they whore. This shall be a statute forever for them throughout their generations. And you shall say to them, any one of the house of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among them, who offers a burnt offering or sacrifice and does not bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting to offer it to the Lord, that man shall be cut off from his people. If any one of the house of the Lord of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among them eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood, and will cut him off from among his people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it for you on the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood that makes atonement by the life. Therefore I have said to the people of Israel, no person among you shall eat blood, neither shall any stranger who sojourns among you eat blood." Dropping down to chapter 18 now. "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You shall not do as they do in the land of Egypt, where you lived, and you shall not do as they do in the land of Canaan, to which I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You shall follow my rules and keep my statutes and walk in them. I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my rules. If a person does them, he shall live by them. I am the Lord. None of you shall approach any one of his close relatives to uncover nakedness. I am the Lord. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father, which is the nakedness of your mother. She is your mother. You shall not uncover her nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife. It is your father's nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your sister, your father's daughter, or your mother's daughter, whether brought up in the family or another home. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your son's daughter or of your daughter's daughter, for their nakedness is your own nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife's daughter, brought up in the father's family, since she is your sister. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's sister. She is your father's relative. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your mother's sister, for she is your mother's relative. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's brother. That is, you shall not approach his wife. She is your aunt. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your daughter-in-law. She is your son's wife, and you shall not uncover her nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your brother's wife. It is your brother's nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of a woman and of her daughter, and you shall not take her son's daughter or her daughter's daughter to uncover her nakedness. They are relatives. It is depravity. And you shall not take a woman as a rival wife to her sister, uncovering her nakedness while her sister is still alive." Dropping down to verse 24. "Do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things, for by all these the nations I am driving out before you have become unclean, and the land became unclean, so that I punished its iniquity, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. But you shall keep my statutes and my rules and do none of these abominations, either the native or the stranger who sojourned among you. for the people of the land who were before you did all of these abominations so that the land became unclean. And we'll stop our reading there, sampling generously from these two chapters. But continue to have your eyes graze over the text as we move through it as well. The Communist Manifesto calls for the abolition of the family. It reads in part, "Abolition of the family. Even the most radical flare-up at this infamous proposal of the communists. On what foundation is the present family, the bourgeois family, based? On capital. On private gain." Unquote. Instead, what they call for is what they call in the manifesto an openly legalized community of women. A euphemism, right? A euphemism for a great pool of women unencumbered by marriage who connect and unconnect with men or other women in a network of sexual relations for which they receive compensation. In other words, legalized prostitution on a societal scale. Not only that, but an eroding of the family was guaranteed by a general perversion of human sexuality, which was traditionally contained and restrained by the boundaries of marriage. Shortly after Karl Marx died, Friedrich Engels, who co-wrote the Communist Manifesto and financed a lot of Karl Marx all of his adult life. In fact, it's a famous story that Marx's mother asked him one day, because they dwelt in utter poverty, said, "Well, what I would like, son, is for you to generate a little capital for the family." Well, Engels remarked after Marx's death, "With every great revolutionary movement, the question of free love comes to the foreground." Does that idea of free love sound familiar? Especially some of you gray hairs here today. It was the rallying cry of the 60s generation, and it came to the foreground, all right. It was the time of the birth control pill, living together, and sex without consequences, supposedly. In fact, we can trace the steady decline of a clear sexual morality from days of free love to homosexual marriage to pedophiles reclassified as minor attracted persons and to the protected class of LGBTQ plus favored fruitcakes. Two, trans athletes in your daughter's locker room and on her playing field. And it has had the cumulative effect of destroying the family in the hearts, lives, and minds of many Americans. The website Echo Sociosphere, has a recent article entitled, "Why Friendships Are the New Family for Gen Z." Friendships are the new family for Gen Z, where they chronicle how a whole new generation has rejected the traditional nuclear family for a network of friends as a substitute for family, whether straight, queer, trans, or a mix of sexualities. For Gen Z, the old model is passé and unworkable in a digital age where devices and social media and DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, right, replace the old standard of stability and regular order. The birth replacement rate demonstrates this destruction of the family. A society needs a fertility rate of 2.1 children per woman if a society's population is to be maintained, just to be stable. And the CDC reported recently that America's fertility rate has plummeted to a historic low of 1.6 children per woman. At this rate, there will be no need for a violent revolution by Marxists. We will have bred ourselves into abolition. Our text today has a purpose: to guard as holy the sexual relationship as given in the garden. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. All other relationships, combinations, or variations are aberrant and deviant. They are transgressions in that they miss the mark. Has the Communist Party succeeded in abolishing the family? Hopefully not. It's up to us as the church to see that that doesn't happen. Let us look at some of the safeguards God has put on our lives. Let us look together to our text today. 2 points I want to make with you. Sanctified sacrifice and sanctified sexual relations are two chapters today as we move through Leviticus. Now, we observed last week that chapter 16, the profound ritual of the Day of Atonement, is the fulcrum, the hinge point of the book of Leviticus. It was the premier day to make God's people holy, presentable in his presence. Prior to 16, we have the distinction between the holy and the common, and there's a marked difference between the sections. In fact, the chapters we undertake now, beginning today, are called the Holiness Code. The Holiness Code. They are so particular in their goal. How do we codify holiness? Behold, chapters 17 through 26, the codification of holiness. And that codification begins with chapter 17. It's a handbook on how to avoid blood guilt. Blood guilt is the opposite of blood atonement. Blood atonement covers, it does away with sin. Blood guilt increases sin. Blood guilt is closely bound up with the shedding of blood, especially innocent blood when it's human. 2 Samuel chapter 21. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. And David sought the face of the Lord. And the Lord said, there is blood guilt on Saul and on his house because he put the Gibeonites to death. The Gibeonites was that tribe that fooled the Israelites when they came into the land and made a covenant of peace with them. Well, Saul went about killing the Gibeonites, broke covenant, and brought blood guilt on Israel. Abigail pacified David and his men when they sought to kill Nabal, her husband, and all of his house, after giving great offense and injury to David and his men. But she intervened. David responded to her, and when she did, blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt. He was going to slaughter everybody. And from working salvation with my own hand, David says. So, when it comes to animal blood, blood guilt has more to do with when, where, and to whom the blood is shed. Remember, we've already seen the one way in how sacrifice is to be conducted and blood handled in order for atonement to be accomplished. One way. There are 1,001 ways for blood guilt to be accrued and imputed. Your text uses that word impute. And not only is righteousness be capable of being imputed, sin can be imputed also, blood guilt as well. And one of those 1,001 ways was a pagan, idolatrous worship practiced in Lower Egypt in the Eastern Delta region. And apparently Israel was intimately familiar with it, having to be warned not to succumb to it in the Promised Land. Joshua tells them, now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord. These were the same gods that Isaiah said would inhabit Israel again in judgment when they went into exile. But wild animals will lie down there and their houses will be full of howling creatures. There ostriches will dwell, and their wild goats will dance. Wild goats will dance. The Hebrew word used here is accurately translated as goat demons by the ESV and the New American Standard. The King James has devils, and the NIV has goat idols, which is pretty close. Now, archaeologists tell us that indeed dancing and copulating with goats and goat demons was part of the detestable rites involved in this idolatrous worship. Goat sacrifices were made and blood offered to these goat demons. So Leviticus has a very particular instance in mind, as well as other general idolatrous practices when it comes to killing animals. Whether it be an ox, a bull, a sheep, or even a pigeon, there was a pagan cult that slaughtered and offered up the blood of that animal. as a tribute to an idolatrous demon god. The latter history of Israel would be full of the religious DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Religious, right? That Israel would practice before going into exile. Diversity, why have just one God when there are so many? Equity, these demon gods are equal to Yahweh the Great, right? So it went for many, many decades. The provisions of Leviticus 17 carefully circumscribed the killing of animals in order that no blood guilt, intended or unintended, might accrue to the ledger of Israel's righteousness. And the chief codice in codifying religious worship, the chief codice here is that the animal be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting. That way, it was clear that God was the object of worship. The eating of meat was actually quite rare in the ancient world, since animals had far greater utility alive. The ox for tilling, the bull for breeding, the cow and the calf for milk and breeding, the goat for milk, the sheep for milk and wool. When an animal was sacrificed, it was usually for a special occasion like Passover or a peace offering. Then meat could be eaten. Slaughtering anywhere else, in or out of the camp, brings blood guilt and the judgment of being cast outside of the camp, which, of course, in the wilderness was certain torturous death. Now, that would change when the promised land was settled. Then it was impracticable to bring every animal slaughtered for consumption to the tent of meeting and later the temple. But the rule would not change for sacrifice. Every animal offered up as a burnt offering or a peace offering or any other must be brought to the entrance to the tent of meeting or else. There were no second or third sites sanctified for convenience. The sacrificial system for Israel was not a franchise operation where you could drive up and offer your sacrifice at the window on every corner. And this is the solemn warning, verses 8 and 9. And you shall say to them, anyone of the house of Israel or the strangers who sojourn among them, who offers a burnt offering or sacrifice and does not bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting to offer to the Lord, that man shall be cut off from his people. Since the life of the sinner went forfeit for his sin, the handling of blood becomes an important feature of religious life in Israel per verses 10 through 16. This is because of a very salient observation made by early man. The life of the creature is the blood, not in the blood. Literally, it's the life of the creature is the blood. A man could live without many components of his body, an eye, a tooth, an arm, a leg, but if his blood drained away, he died. The conclusion? Life itself is bound up with the blood. The life of the creature is the blood. It's profound how modern science and biology has confirmed this insight over the years. We take blood samples because almost everything happening in the body, anywhere in the body, has telltale evidence as to the body's health, or disease, dis-ease, right? Or imbalance. It's all there documented in the blood. Your circulatory system is also the delivery system, the Amazon, if you will, of life for everything good, oxygen, nutrients, the intrepid white blood cells that fight disease. Nothing happens in the body without the blood being intimately involved. Therefore, blood becomes a sacred metaphor for the life of the creature. Precisely because life is sacred before the Creator. He creates life, and he takes it back at his discretion. David says in Psalm 104, when you hide your face, they are dismayed. That is, the creatures of the earth. When you take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. That life is distilled in the blood. As verse 11 says, for the life of the flesh is in the blood, or the life of the flesh is the blood, and I have given it for you on the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood that makes atonement by the life. If I'm not mistaken, this is the memory verse for our study of Leviticus. One book, one week. And for a very good reason. It's an overarching principle that spans Genesis to Revelation. Whether it's the bloodshed to provide animal garments to clothe Adam and Eve, or the blood of the Lamb and the word of the testimony of the saints in Revelation, blood is the distillation of life itself before God. Consequently, to eat blood as one would any other common food is a sacrilege. To consume it in obeisance to another pagan deity was blood guilt of the highest order. It happened in the ancient world of Israel, and it happens throughout redemptive history, right down to our own day and time. Modern Luciferian rituals are blood rituals in which the blood of human sacrificial victims is drunk. It happens today. Do not be naive and deceived. These are ubiquitous in our culture, especially among the power elite. Hollywood's Megan Fox, for instance, boasted about drinking human blood with her lover, Gene Kelly. Even power elites like Hillary Clinton and John Podesta brag about drinking blood with the celebrity witch, Maria Abramovich. She drenches her art and murals in blood as a symbol of human sacrifice. So don't go through your life in America humming and singing and pretending that these things couldn't possibly be going on in modern America. You are but a naive, brainwashed Pollyanna if you do. To eat the blood of a creature, human or animal, was to presuppose one's sovereignty over it, a clear violation of the first commandment. Therefore, there is a prohibition on eating blood. You shall not eat the blood of any creature, for the life of every creature is its blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off, verse 14 tells us. So behold the power of the blood. As John tells us, but if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus, his son, cleanses us from all sin. We have redemptive blood in the Lord Jesus Christ, his life for yours. It's bound up in the blood. Well, that brings us to point two, sanctified sexual relations. Chapter 18. Sex is holy when it is practiced within the bounds of God's prescribing and not caught up in unholy perversion. Sex is holy when it is practiced within the bounds of God's prescribing. We have some of that prescribing here in this chapter, and not caught up in unholy perversion. This chapter is a cautionary tale about sexual relationships among the people as they are poised to enter Canaan. There is one true model presupposed for the people of God, explicitly articulated in Genesis. This at last, Adam says, is born of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. A holy union, holiness code at work here. This chapter is a litany of pagan practices that existed all around Israel, to which they were prone to succumb over time. They were all deviations from the one true model. Each one, if followed, would lead Israel far astray from her mission, that is to generate the one true seed of David's line to the people. Israel's mission, indeed, to crush the head of the serpent, the seed of the woman, and to generate that one true seed of David's line to the people. Close conformity to these rules would bring life. Disobedience to them would bring death. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my rules. If a person does them, he shall live by them. I am the Lord, verse 5, right? The prohibition first articulated is one against sexual relations between close relatives. The euphemism is to uncover nakedness with someone, like sleeping together in English is in our culture when people are actually doing anything but sleeping. If there's any doubt that if you live by the rules, you will live. If you transgress them, you will die. The list details particular, excruciating detail, isn't it? Excruciating detail, verse after verse. The list details particular relationships to be eschewed. sexual relations with father or mother, sexual relations with a sister, whether natural or stepsister, sexual relations with grandchildren, and on. The chapter goes into excruciating detail as to the relations forbidden in order for a people to be holy. Our standards put all of these relationships into summary form in the Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 24 of Marriage and Divorce, section 4, which reads, "Marriage ought not to be within the degrees of consanguinity or affinity forbidden by the word." That's a great word, by the way. Consanguinity, right? We're all going to get this next week. The Ashton kids will be able to give us right away, and probably the McKim kids as well, the definition of consanguinity. "Nor can such incestuous marriages," our standards go on, "ever be made lawful by any law of man or consent of parties, so as those persons may live together as man and wife. The man may not marry any of his wife's kindred nearer in blood than he may be of his own, nor the woman of her husband's kindred nearer in blood than of her own," unquote, from our standards. Consanguinity is a rare word in today's parlance, and it means related by blood, having a common ancestor, according to the Oxford English Dictionary. Leviticus goes into great detail because the variations of consanguinity were endless in antiquity, especially in Egypt, a culture that had been around for 3,000 years already. Moses was familiar with a tangled network of incestuous relationships in the Pharaonic family, having grown up among them 40 years. He knew, he saw, he observed the decadent effects of consanguine marriage. The pharaohs were thought to be direct descendants of the gods, and thus must marry and procreate within family. The degrees of consanguinity were thus very close. Perhaps the most famous is the case of Tutankhamun, for whom we have genetic samples from his tomb. King Tutankhamun was the product of a brother-sister union. His parents were likely full siblings. Genetic analysis reveals this led to a host of health afflictions. That is, a club foot requiring a cane, Tutankhamun, a cleft palate, a weakened immune system, skeletal deformities, and repeated malaria infections. He died at 18 with his short, frail reign and tragic fate, now partly attributed to this inbred lineage. History is replete with such perversity. Power corrupts absolute power, like Egypt or the Habsburgs dynasty corrupts absolutely. Charles II of Spain is another notorious example, living from 1661 to 1700, just not even 40 years. He's exhibit A of this phenomenon in the modern period, right? Of the Habsburg line, Charles II was a product of a family dynasty seeking to preserve power and privilege within their own degree of consanguinity. But oh, the tragic consequences of such blood marriages. He was born to an uncle and niece parents, a common practice aimed at preserving bloodlines and power. Yet genetic isolation manifested physically. He was infirm, mentally slow, racked with epilepsy, unable to even chew properly due to his pronounced jaw structure, which was classic in the Habsburg line, and he died without heirs. His tragic death effectively ended one of Europe's most powerful dynasties, came to a screeching halt. How ironic that a marriage practice aimed at preserving power resulted in creating weakness. Leviticus details other abominations for which human imagination and devilish suggestion know no limits. Avoid sex while a woman is menstruating. Avoid committing adultery with your neighbor's wife. Do not give your children as an offering to Molech, the abominable god of the Ammonites. This was a blood sacrifice of the firstborn. Homosexual relations are forbidden. They're an abomination. Do not engage in sex with animals. That's an abomination. And as we saw in the case of the cult of the goat demon, this was a ritual practice. All of these deviations have real-world consequences. They cast a shadow over redemptive history. The prohibitions are not promulgated to spoil your fun. In the first place, they were given to short-circuit Satan's hopes of destroying the seed of the woman through endless sexual distractions and diversions and perversions that would end up in the destruction of the family and the withering away of procreation altogether. It's happening in our culture today. And so the seed of the woman would no longer be able to crush the head of the seed of the serpent. If humanity had gone the way of Charles II of Spain, it would not only issue in the end of the Habsburg dynasty, but of the human race. That's not exaggeration. Insofar as a culture practices these abominations, a warning for our day, clear perversions of the created order, they cannot fulfill effectively the creation mandate either. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. How long can a nation survive when it brags about normalizing and institutionalizing these aberrations? Dominion of creation will not be taken by pencil-necked, man-bunned, skinny-jean soy boys. America is full of them. Incels, they're called. That is involuntary celibates. And women seek independence from men and chase self-reliance and find in the end only isolation and loneliness and childlessness in their old age, disillusioned and bitter. They are called offals, that is affluent female white liberals. And the earth will not be filled by people who have had their genitals mutilated and removed in surgeries designed to transition them to what? To ugly deformities of nature. Trans people commit suicide at skyrocketing rates, not because society rejects them, but because they have rejected their God-given role as the image of God, as a man or a woman. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. Male and female, he created them, and he blessed them and named them man when they were created, from Genesis chapter 5. The earth will not be subdued by, but the earth will rather overwhelm those who practice same-sex marriage, abort their babies, and call animals family companions. The birth rate is plummeting, families are disappearing, and the misery index is spiking among millennials and Gen Zers. One of the reasons they killed Charlie Kirk was for his advice to his generation. Get married and have more children than you can afford. I like that. Get married and have more children than you can afford. It's funny how having the responsibility for a wife and children motivates a man who loves them. Brings me back. That man goes to superhuman efforts to provide for them. He goes to work and provides resources and adds value to his employer or the larger society if he's independent. Get married, have kids, lots of them. Fill the earth with them. Take dominion of your corner of the earth, your sphere of influence. That's your mandate. Leviticus is not an antiquated, irrelevant law now that the gospel has come. No, it is living, pertinent instruction for all of us who follow Christ. Redemptive history is filled with Satan's attempts at frustrating the progress of redemption in the seed of the woman. A large part of that effort was through the sexual practices forbidden in Leviticus. But providence overcame those obstacles, and indeed, when the fullness of time had come, as Paul says, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, this law, too, right, part of it, born under the law to redeem those who were under the law so that we might receive adoption as sons. Well, let us now come to that place where we see the redemption of man reprised for us in the body and blood of the simple elements of the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.